So welcome everyone. Thank you for joining online. So I'd like to introduce a poem today by Robert Aitken, which is called For Earth Day. And I'll read some of the stanzas out and also talk a little bit about them. So the one I'd like to start with is called Watching Gardeners Label Their Plants, I vow with all beings to practice the old horticulture and let plants identify me. So it's been a time of great uncertainty, and not just this year, but even in the last few years, we've had the Me Too movement and also the Royal Commissions and into institutional abuse, banking abuse, all kinds of abuse. And now we have also the Black Lives Matters movement, and there's a sense of a great deal of upheaval, but also unearthing, so things that had been hidden for a long time, so exploitation of people, whether women or children, black lives, had been allowed for a large extent for a long time, and a lot of that is changing now. So there's a sense of unearthing, but also upheaval. And then, of course, now this year we've had the bushfires, which have kind of, we've sort of almost forgotten about, but they were quite confronting as well. Not just to the extent, but to that sense of, you know, this might be the future, more and more fires, more and more heat, more and more devastation. And then now we have the pandemic, which again has completely upended many lives, not every life, but many, many lives. And amongst all that is also this climate emergency, which is that sense that we're not going on a very good path. You know, there could be many more difficult times ahead. And amongst all that, there could be a sense of some things might be good to turn upside down and to turn inside out. Yeah, so for instance, that line of how can we let plants identify us? So we're very used to looking at the natural world through our human eyes and labeling it, identifying it. But what would it be if we actually looked at the natural world through the eyes of the plants or the animals or the other beings that are there? And in any life, we need some sort of framework. So we have political frameworks and cultural frameworks. Sometimes we might have astrology as a framework. Feminism is another way of looking at the world. Eco-spirituality as well. So to be alive, we have to have some kind of framework to make sense of this complex world. And one of the features of Zen practice is that we acknowledge that we have frameworks and that the frameworks we have are limited and not a true representation of reality. But of course, Zen is also another framework as well. So we're kind of stuck within the frameworks. But frameworks are very important because they guide our values. So they guide how we perceive the world and what we consider to be important and what action we actually take. And a religious practice gives us a strong sense of a framework. So a religious practice like Zen, which we don't often talk about as a religious practice, but if you think about Zen as a religious practice, it's really working directly with the framework, how we perceive things and what we then do as a result of our perception. And so on the Eightfold Path, Buddha's Eightfold Path, the first part of that is actually right view, or also called samadhi, which is the view we have of things, the perspective and the vision. And that kind of comes first because that actually determines all of the other steps on the path, is how we then engage with the other factors of the path, which are also important. But the first thing is actually what kind of view we have. And a key aspect of that is the sense of non-self and interdependence, or what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing. So that's kind of a foundational part of the Buddhist path that we are on. And if we look at the word sacred, So we could say a religious part is, you know, looking at the sacred in life. And sacred is actually the same root as the word sacrifice. So if we have certain values, then we also have to sacrifice something for those values. There can be a sense also in the Buddhist path that we're turning something which can be quite toxic, which are called the three poisons, greed, hatred, and ignorance, into something that is more healing and more healthy. And recently I've been reading about the beginning of the world, evolution, and how for a long time there were just these cells, and then eventually they came up with the process of photosynthesis. And that's a way of turning the sun's energy into carbon dioxide and then turning water into food. And as a result of that process, life was enabled to flourish, and the earth had green, I think it was sort of like slime all around the earth, and it was really doing very well. But unfortunately, part of the byproduct of that was actually producing oxygen, and that was very toxic, and there was more and more oxygen, and it was actually killing life. And so some of the life forms had to retreat back into the mud or bandy together to try and protect themselves. And then life, or whatever it is, came up with this new step, which is actually reversing one of the steps in the stance of photosynthesis and starting to use the oxygen instead of being toxic to turn into food and to make energy. And then we had the beings that breathe, which is, of course, us and animals as well. And ever since then, for millions of years on Earth, we've had this cycle of oxygen and carbon dioxide and that interconnected being between the trees and the plants that use our oxygen and then turn it into carbon dioxide. And then they use our carbon dioxide and turn it into oxygen, and then we use the oxygen. And it's a very finely balanced dance, because if we only had a few extra percentage points of oxygen, then any spark would ignite the atmosphere and everything would blow up. And if we had only a few percentage points less, then there would be no warmth and we couldn't exist. So it's been for millions of years this finely balanced dance. And so every time we breathe, it's actually a gift from the very early ancestors that was given to us. And so one of the challenges that we can look at is how we as students of Zen approach each day with that sense of interbeing and that sense of the gift of the breath from the ancestors. And so another verse in this, which I think is a very beautiful poem by Robert Aitken, goes like this. Waking up in the morning, I vow with all beings to be ready for sparks of the Dharma from flowers or children or birds. So I'll read that once more. Waking up in the morning, I vow with all beings to be ready for sparks of the Dharma from flowers or children or birds. One of the aspects of this particular crisis, the pandemic, has been the social isolation. And I certainly felt very isolated this morning when my internet dropped out, and I knew you were all there meditating and I was not able to join, so I'm happy that I'm here now. But yes, it's that fragility of our connection is all online, or a lot of it is online, and you know, it's not the same as obviously sitting in a room together. And part of our evolutionary makeup is to feel very strongly connected to other people, especially people in our tribe, because that was actually essential for survival. So we're really hardwired to respond to other people's presence and to respond to their smiles and to feel upset when they're upset with us, and to feel cared for when they smile with us. And not only have we lost a lot of that in our day-to-day interactions, but even when we do go out, often it's quite tense. So the atmosphere in a supermarket can be quite tense, no one really looking at each other. In hospitals now, visitors aren't allowed anymore. So if you're lying in hospital now, not only can't you see anyone, except if you're, you know, in palliative care, but you can't see anyone, but the staff will have masks and face shields and are covered in plastic. So you can't even see a nurse smile at you or anything like that. It's a really difficult time for human beings to be, if you're struggling and we haven't got that normal human interaction that sort of is so important for us. And so here's another verse from that poem by Robert Aitken. Sitting alone in Zazen, I vow with all beings to remember I'm sitting together with mountains, children, and bears. Hearing the crickets at night, I vow with all beings to keep my practice as simple, just over and over again. It's one of the things I've been thinking about is for a while now, but particular with the COVID crisis and the bushfire crisis, is that sense of how do we reorientate ourselves to be more part of nature. So rather than the self-centered dream that we're caught in, or the human self-centered dream, is being more orientated towards feeling ourselves to be part of nature. And Robert Atkin has another nice line there. When people praise me for something, I vow with all beings to return to my vegetable garden and give credit where credit is due. So credit is due for those ancient ancestors who gave us the oxygen that we can breathe. So in Zen, we know that there's always going to be upheaval, that nothing is permanent, and we've all had experience in our lives that have already taught us that we might have had illness or lost someone important to us and things like that. So it's not actually new what is happening. But perhaps one of the things that is particularly present at the moment is the social isolation, but also that increased awareness of the unpleasant truth that perhaps we can get a bit, forget about when we're caught up in day-to-day life and being really busy. So it's a sense of there's some really uncomfortable truths that are happening in life, a climate emergency being probably one of the main ones, but also the exploitation of people that's still happening and ongoing. And having to live with that at the same time as we're feeling quite a lot of anxiety. And so the poem finishes like this. Falling asleep at last, I vow with all beings to enjoy the dark and the silence and rest in the vast unknown.